Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Have you ever wondered how much of your past has shaped who you are and the experiences you have today? Or how you would feel if you discovered that the person you dislike most in this life was the one you loved the most in your last life. Joining us today to share the 10 spiritual books that influenced her the most on her life journey is author, meditator, storyteller, and old Himalayan soul, Dina Merriam. A student of Paramahansa Yogananda and a practitioner of Kriya Yoga meditation for over 40 years, Dina Merriam began working in the intimate faith movement in the late 1990s and is currently the chair of the International Advisory Council of the Auraville Foundation in India. During her years of meditation, many vivid memories of past births began to emerge, revealing an intricate and subtle pattern of cause and effect, the law of karma unfolding. These memories became the subject of all of Dina's books, which we'll hear more about later in the show. Dina Merriam joins us now to share the 10 books that influenced her the most, along with some of the great teachings that she learned from her past lives that we can apply to our lives today. Dina Merriam, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you said you cannot date the beginning of your spiritual journey in your current life, but a defining point for you was when you were 20 and you came across the book Autobiography of a Yogi, which gave you a direction and set you on a course of meditation that was to deepen and expand over the years.
That's right. You know, Autobiography of a Yogi is a spiritual classic, and many people begin their search with that book. But for me, it was the end of the search. As soon as I read the book, I recognized Yogananda as my guru from the past. And I just, that was it for me. I didn't need to search anymore. He had already left his body, but he had an organization, and I learned how to meditate. And he became a guiding force in my life.
Yeah. Well, he's the first book on your list. His book was published in 1946. And my goodness, I think it is definitely in our top 10 of the 10 best lists. It gets mentioned over and over again, and with good reason. I personally found it a very impactful book.
Oh, there's so much in it. You know, it's like a whole, it opens a universe.
Yes.
To explore. Yeah. You know, yeah. And then through meditation, you explore that universe that he invites you into.
Would you have loved to have met him?
I did meet him in the past. And, you know, the past is as real to me as the present. And that was very comforting to know that I've had a history with him. And then I've had many experiences with him on the inner plane. And so the inner relationship is more important than the outer. That took me a long time to realize. I mean, for years, I mourned the fact that I couldn't go talk to him and ask him questions. But I know that when you asked him questions, he would say, go meditate. He didn't tell you what to do. And so I had to learn to find him inside.
Mm.
Well, so that was a great teaching.
I'm sure. I have to ask, you knew him in a previous life. I mean, what was he like? What kind of personality? Who was he in a previous life?
Well, what in my book, which we'll talk about later, My Journey Through Time, I talk about my birth just previous to this. When as Yogananda, he took the one trip back to India in 35, 36 and passed through Germany. He tried to see Hitler. He said if he could have a few moments with Hitler, He could change the course, but he couldn't see Hitler. But he was passing through Germany, and I happened to have been in Germany as a refugee, sort of. And so I was invited to a talk that he gave. So it was a very brief interaction, but just the power of his gaze, it was like when he looked at you, he saw into your soul. And that's what stayed with me, the power of his gaze. And it's like he was like going through all your births and knowing everything about you. And so when I saw his image on the cover of the book, it was like, I know this man. Of course, at that time, I didn't have the recall. It was years later that I recalled that birth.
Interesting that he wanted to influence Hitler, because Sri Aurobindo had also wanted to influence Hitler and used to meditate and project ideas. And
it said, I don't know if it was Shubin for the mother, that they put into his mind to go into Russia. He was undecided, and they put that thought into his mind. So I think that there were many masters working on. They say that there was a powerful Asuric figure behind Hitler, and there were the mother, Sri Aurobindo, the partner, the mother, talks about how she was battling that Asura who was influencing. Asura is a demonic kind of energy, was influencing Hitler.
Yeah. Well, book two on your list is The Holy Science by Swami Sri, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, Yukteswar?
Yukteswar, who was the guru of Yogananda.
Yeah.
And the reason why I put that book there is because he describes an ancient theory of the East, which is the Yuga cycle of history. And he was a master mathematician and astronomer, and we calculated. You know, people say, oh, we're in the Kali Yuga, that's why things are so bad. But he recalculated according to, I mean, this is a scientific astronomical event, how we passed through our galaxy, how our whole solar system moves through the galaxy, entering areas of higher electromagnetic energy, which increases the spiritual development of humanity. And he calculated that we're out of the Kali Yuga, that a few hundred years, 1900, I think, is when we officially came into the next Yuga, the Dwapara Yuga, which is the technological age, the age of electricity, where humankind understands the subtle properties of electricity. So more and more people, when I talk about this, are saying, yeah, we're out of the Kali Yuga. But a lot of the mindsets of the Kali Yuga are still with us.
Yes.
So we're in the process of trying to shed that, which I think is some of the tension we experience in the world today, of really moving into a higher age, not fully leaving behind the old structures and mindsets.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. And we're hearing so much about the yugas lately.
Yeah, I put on my list another book about the yugas, which we'll talk about when we come to that.
Well, let's talk about that now, because that's by our old friend Joseph Selby, The Yugas, the keys to understanding our hidden past, emerging energy age, and enlightened future. And Joseph published that in 2010.
So since reading Shukteswar's book when I was in my early 20s, I've been very interested in this understanding the cycle of the yugas, to understand where we are historically, why we're having such difficulties now, and what the future looks like. And Joseph, and so I've read everything I can on the yugas. There are a few other books out there by students of Yogananda who've taken up this subject. But Joseph is the most in-depth because he talks about the consciousness. So for example, Treta Yuga, which is the next yuga, where it's pre-writing, so we don't have any written history of this. It ended around 3000 BCE, which is when history begins, 3000 BCE. So in other words, we don't have historical records of the higher yugas, but we have what we call myths, the Garden of Eden, you know, a golden age. So that's been held in the collective memory, but there's nothing written because they didn't need writing. People communicated through thought, through telepathy. Mind powers were so much greater. So these great structures that people can't figure out, how were the pyramids built? How was Stonehenge built? Well, mind power. It was definitely something that we don't understand now. I mean, they didn't have the tools that we have now. They didn't have, you know, bulldozers to pull things. So they had mind power. And so it was very interesting to me, Selby's book, that he goes into the consciousness of the different yugas. Mm. So in this Treta Yuga, there wasn't the consciousness of separateness from nature. We had a more unified consciousness. Individuation, ego consciousness hadn't fully developed. So while linear historians look at this as an evolution of society, you can look at it as a spiritual decline. You know, all the social ills that we have now, brutality, wars, the weapons, didn't exist in that earlier time. Slavery, domination, gender oppression didn't exist because the consciousness was different. Those thoughts didn't even enter the human mind until much later, until you come into a descending cycle of Dwapara Yuga and then Kali Yuga, when all of these social ills, the human mind gets filled with all kinds of adharmic ways of thinking.
So how does that happen? I mean, you know, how is that introduced into the collective consciousness?
Well, that's a key question. I mean, you know, according to what Shri Yukteswar said in Selby, the yugas are determined, and all of the ancient cultures talked about the great year, which was a 24,000 year cycle. So it was known that there is this multiple ways of measuring time. There's the weeks, months, years, and then there's the great year, which we go through all these different cycles of ascending consciousness and declining consciousness. And so it has less to do with outer development as we think of it, and more to do with the consciousness of people, spiritual consciousness of people. So, and it has to do with our movement through the galaxy, our solar system's movement through the galaxy. And so, I mean, that's a very sort of basic general understanding of it. And how the decline happens, well, the more we focus on the outer world, the less we focus on the inner world. So in the highest yuga, you could cross over and, you know, there's in every tradition, there are legends of seeing the gods walking on earth, the angels walking on earth. Well, that's because the perception, you could see them, you could see into these other dimensions. The film, the consciousness was such that you could perceive the subtler dimensions. And there was much more focus on the inner world than on outer development. I mean, you just lived on the earth without interfering with it. But the more we focus on shaping the outer world, dominating the outer world, the more we drift away from the inner reality. And so we've reached a pinnacle now of complete absorption in materialism, which was, you know, the Kali Yuga consciousness. All you could see was the material.
And so how is that going to change in this new technological age?
Well, it's again a gradual process. I mean, we see changes just in our lifetime of meditation. When I was younger, you couldn't talk about meditation openly. You had to be a closet yogi. You know, you couldn't talk about karma openly. If you were vegetarian, they thought you had an illness. You know, the things that were a few decades ago looked at as bizarre are mainstream now. Mm-hmm. And so I think the growth of the spiritual community, which will continue to deepen and grow, is what's going to create change.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joseph also wrote your fourth book, The Physics of God, How the Deepest Theories of Science Explain Religion and How the Deepest Truths of Religion Explain Science. He published that one in 2021.
This had a great effect on me. I was in my position at Oroville. I was asked to organize a conference on science and religion, science and spirituality and human evolution. And I didn't know about Joseph's book, so I was looking for physicists who could speak about quantum physics. And we found a few and who did sort of online presentations. And then I came across Joseph's book. I've known about Ananda, the community that he's part of, but I hadn't known about his writing. And I was fascinated because I deeply believe that the language of the future will be scientific. A lot of young people, I think religion has sort of worn itself out, and you know, even what we call celestial realms, we will call it's other dimensions, you know. And so Joseph, actually using scientific language, describes what the masters have all talked about. Mm. And I was fascinated by that. And it actually deeply affected my thinking to realize that through a completely different avenue, not through belief, but through experiments, that the cutting edge of physics is approaching spiritual science.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I love that particular book. In fact, I chose it as one of our occasional bookworms in the book club, where I share the books that have made a big impact on me and that I'm telling everybody about currently. And that was one of them.
So you knew of that book?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's the first time I've seen it on anybody's list, and I'm really pleased to see it there. It deserves its place.
Absolutely.
Mm, yeah. So book number 5 is Fearless in Tibet, The Life of the Mystic Terton Sogyal by Matteo Pistone, published in 2014.
Well, this is a great book, maybe not so widely known outside some Tibetan practitioners, Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, but this sage, this mystic, was actually the teacher of the previous Dalai Lama. And he, in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, he saw the possibility of a dire future for Tibet. And he warned against certain things. He warned against sectarian fighting. There were all kinds of things going on, black magic. I mean, he was the protector of the previous Dalai Lama, and there was some sorcerer who had put a death curse on the Dalai Lama that he had to battle spiritually. So he was engaged in many spiritual battles. And then in the early years of the 20th century, when the Chinese made some advances before the final occupation, he was advised, and he was getting direct guidance from Guru Rinpoche, of course, who lived many, many hundreds of years ago, to go to a certain place, Shambhala, to hold the spiritual energy of Tibet. And I've wondered if that's a physical place or an astral place. And so I realized at that point, so there are many, many indications of why what happened to Tibet and how Tibet might get itself out of this situation. And so he talked about how the sages had to leave and hold the spiritual energy of Tibet until such a time when the Dharma could again flourish. Now, part of the reason, I'm sure, for the occupation was to bring the wisdom of Tibetan Buddhism to the world, which has happened. But I think there's also been, it's happened in India and it's happened with Tibetan teachers. A lot of them who come to the West succumb to the temptations of the West, and there have been many scandals, because it's a different reality here. You know, there's much greater access to temptation. And so what I realized is that we are part of anybody who feels connected to Tibet, and I do because I've had a past there, is part of the collective that needs to sort of purify ourselves in order to help help Tibet free itself, which I believe will happen at some point in the future. When? It's an unknown. But it's important to really uphold the Dharma and to watch one's behavior. What, you know, every time a great teacher slips, that's harming the cause.
Mm. Well,
connect their individual behavior to the collective.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we are harder on people that we look upon as teachers than we are on ourselves or anyone else. You know, anyone else can fail, but they can't.
Well, because they're models for the rest of us, and so yeah. You know, who wants to be a teacher, really? Yeah. You know, it's a big responsibility. It's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
Because you have to guide other souls, you know, and And it was easier to do it when you're in a society that supports it.
Yes.
You know, where you live in a monastery or you're just society supports that. You know, with all the temptations out in the world today, it's much harder to uphold that.
Indeed. So book number six is The Return of the Feminine and the World Soul by Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, published in 2009.
So I read this when I was when I was first setting up the Global Peace Initiative of Women, which came about when I saw the lack of women's voices in the interfaith movement, I mean, a complete absence. And through Yogananda, I've come to worship the Divine Mother, because that was his form of, that was his approach to the Divine Mother. Everything was about the Divine Mother. And so I realized that was deep in me. One of the things that attracted me to Hinduism was because the Devi is so central. And when I read Llewellyn's book, where he saw that the awakening of that feminine as essential for humanity right now, without that, we can't heal. And so he's a Sufi mystic living in Northern California, and English of English birth. It just resonated so much with the work that I intuitively was drawn to. And I thought, wow, it's not just my own feeling. This is confirmation that there is something to this, the awakening of the understanding of the feminine divine energy is essential for humanity right now. And I've seen that happen more and more. You know, when I started this work, it was very hard to talk about it.
Yeah. So many people are talking about it now, you know, and the consciousness is moving through the collective, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So book number seven, I'm not sure I can pronounce this. Tapaswaji? Is that right? Saint who lived for 185 years.
Oh, Tapaswaji.
Tapaswaji.
Tapaswaji. So he was an Indian sage, saint, who had some very interesting experiences. He left the world for the Himalayas when India was under Mughal rule. He returned when it was under British rule, 150 years later. And he had a practice, which I guess some of the yogis undertake, where he could renew his body. So he lived, you know, I don't remember exactly how many years, and I don't think anybody really knows how long he lived, but he was well over 150 years old. But he encountered figures from India's past who had lived thousands of years earlier as he was traveling through. So he was able to penetrate into subtler realms. He also encountered many of the devis and devas. And so he recounts the story that somebody writes about him. He didn't write, but he recounts to this devotee, I guess, his stories of his wanderings, and the encounters he had with renowned figures from the past.
I mean, I think the title says the saint who lived for 185 years. How did they do that? How do they renew their bodies?
So twice he went into what he called a dark retreat. You know, the sunlight ages us. He went into a dark retreat. I don't remember for how many weeks, where he just lived on, I don't know, maybe, I think it was milk. And he was in a state of deep meditation. And he came out and his body was renewed. I don't know. I mean, I think sort of returning to sort of late middle age, not to a youth. And then he could keep going. So he did that twice. And there's a man I know at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram who was so inspired by this that he also wanted to, there are things called dark retreats, that he went into a dark retreat. He's in his early 50s. And I saw him after and I didn't see any change in him. I think it wasn't so much the dark retreat as his meditative state.
I would say there has to be more to it than that. And so many people are interested now in, you know, achieving or increasing their longevity. And we have the evidence that, you know, a low-calorie diet is enormously helpful in that regard. So I guess also if you're on a retreat, you're in a deep meditative state and you're not ingesting, you know, all those wasteful calories, that must help too.
Well, we've seen in our lifetime people are living longer. But I mean, if there's a specific reason, it makes sense. But I see no problem with moving on to the next chapter.
Yeah, it's an interesting, thorny subject, isn't it? Because most people want to live forever, but nobody wants to grow old. So, yeah, if one can stay at one's peak, then it might be worth it. But if you can't, hey, move on and renew.
Get a new body.
Get a new one. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to a No BS Spiritual Club interview, and sharing the 10 books that had the biggest influence on her life journey is author, meditator, storyteller, and founder and convener of the Global Peace Initiative of Women, Dina Merriam, whose books offer a study of the universal law of cause and effect, how events in our life, our deeds, thoughts, and reactions impel the process of rebirth. We'll be back with more from Dina Merriam after the break.
OM Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and when I'm not hosting OM Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion, and there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com, click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself. Invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. OM Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OM Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OM Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OM Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OM Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OM Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Dina Merriam, book number 8 on your list is the best-selling astrology classic, The Inner Sky, by Stephen Forrest, published in 2012.
I didn't know which book to put by Stephen. Stephen has had a huge influence on me, and I'm sure many people have mentioned Stephen's books.
actually, I'm probably only one, I think. One person.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he introduced me to evolutionary astrology, which uses astrology to understand the soul's growth, your current work, where you've come from, where your past is leading you to, and what your future holds. And so it gave me a completely different understanding. I sort of didn't never sort of liked this predictive, am I going to have a relationship? What does it mean about my jobs? To me, that wasn't the greatest benefit of understanding astrology. But understanding it in terms of your soul's evolution and then collective evolution. What does it mean for the collective, for the evolution of humanity? So he introduced me to this, and I think The Inner Sky is a good introduction to Stephen's work.
I've studied astrology for more years than I care to count. I hadn't come across this book, so I am going to have a look at it. And book number 9 is by a man, my favourite human at the moment, Christopher Bache, Life Cycles, Reincarnation and the Web of Life. And this was published in 1991.
So how that book came across, I wrote my first book, My Journey Through Time, which goes back to my last 5 lives. And I talk about how these memories came to me. And a Christian theologian I know emailed me and said, I want to talk to you about your book. And I was nervous. I thought, how he's going to respond. And so I didn't respond to him, even though he's a good friend. But he contacted me again. He said, Dean, I have to talk to you. So we finally spoke. And he said that after reading my book, he started researching, something I never did because it wasn't to me a matter of belief. These were my experiences. So he came across that book and he wanted me to read that book. And he said to me, it's irrefutable now that in his mind, that how can you deny rebirth when there's so many people who've had these past recalls, especially children who couldn't have accessed that information any other way. And so I read that book and I realized how important it is for people who didn't grow up with the understanding of reincarnation. And to have it sort of confirmed by science, by psychologists. And I think that he's a professor of religion as well. So I thought that was an important book. And it made me realize that for the general public, I do believe that more and more people are going to see this as the way the universe works and see themselves as having many, many incarnations. And it changes everything. It changes your relationship with death. It changes everything.
Absolutely, yeah. Book number 10 is the Bhagavad Gita. You haven't said which version. There are so many out there that it's difficult to know. But why is this on your list?
So the Bhagavad Gita has been something that I've studied for multiple lifetimes. But it came to me soon after reading Yogananda's book. And it became a guide to life. So I was just, I read the Penguin edition, but since then, Yogananda has interpretations, 2 volumes of interpretations. But the slokas are very simple, and I read it so frequently when I was in my 20s that now the slokas come to me. It's like somebody said to me yesterday, actually, how do we know that we don't backtrack? How do we know that the next life we're not going to be further back and we have to start all over? I quoted the Gita, no step is lost on this path. You take up where you left off. And so the teachings of that are so relevant for life. And it talks about, how the body just assumes a new garment and how the soul assumes a new garment and the body is a garment for us to do our work. So there's so many, and it's simple. It's very simple. Basic truths about life. I mean, of course, there are complex ideas in there, but it's a small book that can be a guide for life. So I could not include it on the books that have influenced me.
Mm. Well, that's your 10 best list. You mentioned, normally I would ask someone, who would you most like to meet of all the authors? You've already said that you have met Yogananda, but not in the usual way. Is there anybody else, any author on your list that you would love to meet?
Trenton Sogyal, the Tibetan. I've just finished a book on Tibet, and so my mind is still very much in Tibet, and whole frame of what Tibet contributes and what its history has been and where its future is, is something that I dwelt on for a year while I was writing the book. And so I would like to meet him.
Yeah, Tibet seems to be one of those countries that has a special kind of different energy in people's consciousness. And I don't know whether that's, you know, because of its deep history. But it always seems to be one of those countries apart, as far as I'm concerned, you know, elevated apart.
Well, you know, in my book, I talk about the outer history. You know, it was a great empire, and there was a lot of tension between Buddhism coming in and the indigenous religion, which was very much like all indigenous religions, very nature-based worship of the elements, but had a lot of truth to it. And what we call Tibetan Buddhism today is really an integration of the two. And that's why of all the Buddhist lineages, they preserve the deities, the cosmic energies that we call the deities. Mm. And there's a lot of similarity with Hinduism. Some of the deities are just given different names. Tara, you know, a lot of female deities. And I think that there was a strong spiritual energy in Tibet that's very ancient.
Mm.
And I mean, that's why for so many of us, it holds that place. I mean, it's true of India too. You know, why does India hold? It's like a spiritual giant, right? For many of us. Mm-hmm. We don't feel that way about China, even though there was a great Taoist tradition and Taoist masters. When we think of China, we think of something else. You know, we might think it's culture, you know, or it's a great civilization, but we don't think of its spiritual power in the way that Tibet or India evokes.
Yeah. So as with all of your books, your latest release, To Dance with the Dakinis, In Search of Self, is a study of the universal law of cause and effect. But what makes this one different is that you bring the law of karma to life. You share the story of three lives, beginning in 12th century Tibet, and then you unravel the threads that link them together. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the bulk of the book takes place in 12th century Tibet, where the character undergoes a traumatic situation. She's been taken in by a, sort of like a false teacher, a cult leader, and she can't extricate herself. I mean, a beloved husband has died, and she's alone, and she falls under the influence of this man, and she can't extricate herself. So she falls into a dark pit, but there are people to rescue her, and she's got a dear friend who does rescue her, a woman who's been a teacher of sorts, and helps her find someone to lead her into her past to find the source of the problem. So again, we see our surface problems, but how often can we find the source of it? To heal it, it's helpful to know the source. So she then goes back into her life just previous, where she finds him. But again, that's still not the source. You know, she's running from him. This man is obsessed with her. He seems to want to harm her. And she has to go back even further to find that he was an abandoned son of hers and thought of her in a very bad way and developed a feeling of retribution. He was going to get back of her and pursued her. This unfolded over centuries. And once she saw that this man who was, you know, kind of like the epitome of evil to her had been her son, she's going through a mix of emotions, right? And she ends up really helping him, healing him of his anger. And then that's the main thing. She resolves that relationship, and then she dies. And she's reborn in India and has to face the man's number two, who she didn't resolve her relationship with, who was born as her brother. And so she spends that life resolving that relationship. So it you know, as I write these books, I actually relive them, relive the stories. And it's made me look at my own life in a different way. What are the unresolved relationships? Mm. Even if I can't see, you know, the cause, the earlier, I know that I want to heal it because I don't want to have to find another encounter. You know, it's like, tend to it now. Don't put it off into the future. You know, it's an old saying. Don't put off into the future what you can do today.
But we must have hundreds of these. We must have so many, you know, if it's a constant cycle of birth and rebirth. You know, we could spend infinity unraveling some of these patterns and consequences. You
know, I think, though, that I don't think we have to address every relationship that we've ever had. I think that there are sort of like a few symbolic things that help us grow. So it's interesting because in my current birth, I've had an antipathy. It's like I can spot cult leaders or people who seem to control others. And I've had friends running off to this one and that one. And because I found Yogananda so early, maybe, I just also, it's like, I don't even go there. And I think that experience that I had in the, you know, in Tibet left such a deep imprint on me that I'm sort of immune from being sucked into those kind of relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's very common, actually. You know, we have people who have cult in political sphere and religious sphere where people just are not, they become mindless. They just, you know, fall into, it's like mind control almost.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. How long, I mean, over what period of time were you gathering the knowledge of these lifetimes?
So that last book, the book's generally taken me about a year to write. But the experiences comes to me in waves over a period of several months. And I write it all down and then I have the full narrative. And then I go back and I edit it. And then I go back and I edit it. So I would say over a period of several months, I once the door opens, it's like a floodgate. And it's like I'm in a movie. I see scenes, I hear things. It's like I'm sucked into a movie. And I'm just recording what I'm seeing and hearing. And the gift to me and all that, and it's difficult. It's no question it's difficult because I'm experiencing the emotions again. So, you know, when Padma's husband, Yeshe, dies, I went through all of that, of experiencing the loss of a very dear one. I live alone, and so I isolate myself. When I'm writing, I really have to delve into this. And the gift to me is the teachings that come. And what I realized is I'm hearing again teachings that I didn't understand when they were first given. I'm a more evolved soul now. So I'm not that person that I was a few hundred years ago, 800, whatever it was. And I couldn't understand then what I can understand now. So it's like I'm given another opportunity to hear from Dalha, to hear her teachings again, to experience her again. And at the time, I was sort of much less awakened or not quite getting it. And so I see myself at an earlier stage of development, all the books that I've written, even just my life just previous to this, I see myself at an earlier stage of development, which is interesting. And I'm now in the middle of a book called Memories of a Future Life.
I was going to ask you about the future.
Well, I project myself 200 years into the future, and I'm seeing a more evolved version of myself. So that's also been very interesting.
the problem with having regressions, you know, having these memories, is I think that one could very easily get overly engaged in the identity of who one was. Have you experienced that at all as an issue?
Yes. And I don't encourage people. I don't encourage people to go to past life regression. I think whatever rises organically, you have to deal with. The first time I had the experience, it was very destabilizing for me when I just was back in my life just previous. I was a single mom raising two teenage sons, keeping a job, and it was very destabilizing. If I didn't have my meditation practice, it would have been much, much harder. I do get absorbed when I'm writing. I get absorbed in that personality, and I have to pull myself out and say, I'm not that person anymore. I've gone through a lot of growth and development, had many experiences. I'm not that person anymore. And so it's a funny thing because I recognize certain aspects of myself that are still there. So it's like I'm the culmination of everything. So there's a little piece of me from that life and a little piece of me for that life and a little piece of me from that life. But I'm not that personality anymore. But when you realize that, I realize I'm not going to be Dina either in the future.
Yeah. But on, you know, by the same token, what about the people? I mean, you've described meeting again, you know, the person who helped you and clearly a dearly beloved, you know, soul. Is there not, do you not feel bereft? You know, you've experienced how you felt about that person and now they're not with you. You know, do you spend the life looking for them? Have they come back? Am I going to meet them again?
Two things have happened to me in this process. It's been a great learning, actually, the process of writing these books. The first thing is time collapses. What is time? You know, the past seems as real to me at moments. And then now I'm writing in the future. I'm in the future. I feel like I'm living that future life now. So this whole thing of time, which is a construct of the mind, and it's the same thing of space, because in the books I talk about in between lives. So in this Dance with Dakinis, there are two sections, which are the in between, you know, which is more real, that or this. I mean, when we die here, we're there. When we are born here, we die there. Which is the reality? Mm. And so I've also begun to maintain contact with people who are in that subtle realm. And so I don't, and that's sort of like a focus for me now, is crossing the space bridge, crossing time and space. I mean, because they're constructs of the mind. And I think Selby talks about this. Mm. He talks about the physical universe as a holographic projection of the energy verse, and that we exist in that energy verse, projecting ourselves into the material realm to have an experience. So if we can connect, you know, with our other self who's projecting, the projector, then we can be aware of ourselves in that realm at the same time that we're in this realm. So it's mind-boggling in a way. It's hard for the rational mind to grasp it, but I do have experiences with beings who I've been close to who are not in physical incarnation now.
In the future, you know, I mean, first of all, do these experiences come to you unsought? You're not working at them. They are spontaneous, presumably.
Mm. They're spontaneous because yeah. I don't know what's coming next. I was so surprised. Yeah. To find myself in Tibet and to be a follower of Bon. I didn't know anything about Bon, the indigenous religion of Tibet.
Yeah.
And so they come spontaneously and I don't repress them. I mean, that's the thing. I wouldn't know how to repress them, really. I mean, they're so powerful. And luckily I can write about them. That's my sadhana, actually, to write about them. And I've had many people write to me saying that it awakened, reading my book awakened memories, their own memories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So your book about the future life, is there anything that you can tell us about the, you know, the environment there, you know, how we will be living in that time? Or was it all just your own personal navigation?
Well, a lot of it is my personal navigation, but there are definite things. So I project myself two lifetimes ahead, 200 years. And looking back at the previous life, which is my next birth. So there are two births. And what I see happening, and I deeply believe this actually, because other people have said this to me, is that the growth of the meditation movement, the growth of the spiritual movement and the deepening of the spiritual movement will help us avert the worst of the potential scenarios. So now I say to people, please meditate. This is my only message. Do your spiritual practice, whatever it is. It could be prayer, whatever it is. But it's that, it's the deepening of our spiritual practice and the growing of our collective that will help us navigate through the things we have to navigate. And so, you know, one of my inspirations for writing this book was all the dystopian scenarios that are out there. And I say, thought creates reality. That's one thing we have to know, the power of thought. And why are we creating a dystopian future for ourselves? People don't realize the power of the thought. So, you know, collectively, we can project a more positive. It doesn't mean there are not going to be challenges, because we're sort of moving through a transition, and so a lot of the structures of our society have to change, economic, social, governance. And I do see a decentralization, and I do see the clumping together of spiritual communities, people of like mind, sort of coming together to form new social. That's why I'm so interested in Oroville, actually. Because to me, that's an experiment. They've not been fully successful. They've had successes and failures. But there'll be future articulations of this kind of thing, of kind of new social ways of social organization. And so I see that as being a part of the future. So I'm still in the process, and I've just come back from Oroville. So, you know, I have to go, in order for me to see, I have to kind of let it pass through me, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel myself that I'm a scribe, a channel. And please let it pass through me. Let me see some things that are positive that will be of benefit.
One of the things that is concerning many people right now is the move globally towards authoritarianism. Is that something that is still evident in 200 years' time, or have we moved through that?
I think a lot of the struggles that we see now are part of the breakup or reaction to the breakup. And I think it will pass. I think what concerns me in the future is the role that artificial intelligence will play in our lives. In other words, will these entities be decision makers? How will we, because I see the human population reducing.
Yes.
Just naturally.
Many people say that, yeah.
And that's going to be a boon to the earth. I mean, it's going to help us rebalance our relationship with the earth. And so will a lot of the jobs then be taken by these artificial entities, which can bring benefit, but also everything has benefit and a downside. Will we have the wisdom to use it at all wisely? So that's what I'm trying to see. But I think that there's going to be a, as I said, decentralization into pockets of communities. But again, how we get there, we're projecting a few hundred, you know, decades. In the immediate decades, what we have to go through, that I haven't written about. Mm. It's once we get through some of the more difficult challenges that we're facing now.
Yeah. You know, the book is called, your latest book is called To Dance with Dakinis. Can you just quickly explain what a Dakini is?
A Dakini is a celestial female, or a non-material being, a light being, who can come to Earth and assume a physical body. And it's usually for a higher purpose. But To Dance with Dakinis describes a time thousands and thousands of years ago when such beings walked the earth and interacted with human beings. And of course, then there was an aspiration to become like that. I think a lot of our aspirations toward a higher state of consciousness came from our encounter with such beings at a time, in a higher yuga, at a time when humanity was in a more awakened place.
We're losing your picture, Dina. You're gradually moving to one side. If you can come back, then we can see your face.
I'm trying to adjust the light because the sun has come in. I've had to move my computer. Is that better?
No, you've gone actually the other way. That's better. That's better.
Okay, there we are.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. So when is your next book out?
It's good. Oh, next year.
Next year.
Next year.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm afraid we're almost out of time now. So, Dina, thank you so much for adding your 10 best list to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's Library of Recommendations.
Thank you, Sandy. It was wonderful to be here.
You're welcome. Dina Merriam's books include My Journey Through Time, a spiritual memoir of life, death and rebirth, When the Bright Moon Rises, The Awakening of Ancient Memories, and To Dance with Dakinis in Search of Self. For more information about her work, visit her website at dinamerriam.com. This show is also available as a free downloadable podcast on the Om Times website and on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Amazon, and Audible. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me, and thank you again to Dina Merriam.
Thank you, Sandy.